Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. AIG employees will give back some of their controversial bonuses, according to Edward Liddy, the company's CEO. He testified before a House Financial Services Committee today about the recent payout in bonuses totaling $160 million.
This morning, I've asked the employees of AIG Financial Products to step up and do the right thing. Specifically, I've asked those who receive retention payments in excess of $100,000 or more to return at least half of those payments. Some have already stepped forward and offered to give up 100% of their payments.
The bonuses, actually $165 million worth, were paid out to members of AIG's London-based financial products division, the same employees who made the risk investments that brought the company to the brink of failure. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been watching the hearings. Gail, they've been going on all morning. Earlier, officials charged with overseeing AIG were grilled, but now Liddy is at the table. It's getting quite heated.
It is. I'm hearing from members that this is the most intense issue that they faced in their political careers.
Interesting, and it's the bonuses, not even the finances, the way AIG got into this mess. And we should note that Liddy inherited the mess from former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who asked him to take over after the bailout. Although when Liddy was CEO of Allstate Insurance, he also made $14 million in bonuses on top of $100 million or so in salary, and they were called retention bonuses. Now, there was quite a bit of back and forth with Congressman Barney Frank today on the distinction between retention bonuses and other bonuses. Fill us in.
Well, they're trying to make a crack in the argument that Mr. Liddy is making and AIG officials that if we don't hold on to our talented people, then we're going to fall apart and the taxpayer will not be paid back. So the fact that the bonuses are to keep people as opposed to simply reimburse them part of their compensation is becoming critical. But the problem is a lot of the people have left. A lot of the people that have been given bonuses have left. And so it kind of puts the lie to that that whole strategy. But it's just part. It's part of the intensity of the controversy on this issue right now.
Well, Barney Frank also asked, can we have the names of the AIG workers who didn't give back their bonuses? Liddy said no. It would have to be, he'd have to be promised the names wouldn't get out. Frank said he couldn't promise that. And he said, well, if you won't do this, I will subpoena the names. And then Liddy said that these people have been getting death threats.
All the executives and their families should be executed with piano wire around their necks. My greatest hope. If the government can't do this properly, we the people will take it in our own hands and see that justice is done.
AIG CEO Liddy reading some of the death threats that were coming to some of these AIG executives. That's quite a moment.
Well, Barney Frank's response was also pretty interesting. He said, well, we all get these, which is also a level of intensity of public life I hadn't been aware of. But you've even got members of Congress. Chuck Grassley, who's a ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, in effect suggested that those receiving bonuses ought rather to be, as the Japanese, committing suicide, which is a he later backed off of that. He said, I just want them to suggest that they're sorry.
He said it was rhetorical.
It just shows you how concerned they are right now, Republicans and Democrats, that the public anger on this is so intense that they may not be able to pass a further bailout if it's needed. And then what?
Well, we have David Leonhardt lined up. We'll ask him that. But he is also rising under the burner that is Treasury Secretary Geithner. Today, Barack Obama came out and made statements that he had confidence in Geithner, that Geithner was handed this mess by the last administration, although people are saying when Geithner was the Fed chair in New York, he helped orchestrate the AIG salaries. So in just the minute we have, do you think, how do you feel about Geithner's future?
What Obama actually said was he had complete confidence, which is a very dangerous phrase in Washington. It's very rare for anyone to survive an expression of complete confidence. That suggests how very serious the attacks are on that person. The key will be next week. Secretary Geithner and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke will appear before the full Finance Committee on the House side and have to answer some very, very tough questions about what they knew and when they knew it. And if they don't, if the Treasury Secretary doesn't do a better job at articulating that than he has today, I think it's going to be very difficult for him to be an effective voice for this administration.
That's Gail Chadwick, Christian Science Monitor, following today's hearings in Washington. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Let's turn to David Leonhardt of the New York Times. And David, you know, we've been talking about how some of these financial instruments didn't work. You know, it was a house of cards. Now it feels as if we're watching the unraveling of the justification for Wall Street's pay structure. We just talked about the phrase retention bonuses. Do you feel like you're watching The Wizard of Oz and we're seeing behind a curtain?
I do. I think that's a nice analogy. My concern is twofold. One, once the immediate anger passes, are we actually able to put in place some changes that lead Wall Street's pay structure to change? Because it has real economic downsides, the pay structure that Wall Street had. Essentially, it held out the promise of enormous rewards without actually tying them to performance.
Right.
The big lie is that they were tied to performance.
Right, and that they were used to retain people.
Yeah.
You write that retention bonuses were unnecessary for chief executives. They loved their jobs and all their money. They weren't going anywhere. And that people right below them might still leave and might have left without a retention bonus. But you talked to management experts who said, so what? There are other people, and it's not that hard to clean up these messes.
It isn't that hard. I mean, it's not trivial, but it is not nearly as hard as AIG and as Edward Liddy is suggesting. And Simon Johnson, who's an economist at MIT and used to work at the IMF, he was part of this really nice primer that This American Life, the Chicago mm-hmm. public radio show, just did on the banking crisis.
Right.
And one of the points he made on that show was that bankers often exaggerate how difficult it is cleaning up the mess that they've created. And if you think about it, they have a number of reasons to do so, right? It's in their interest to say, oh, yes, I made this mess, but if you fire me, if you kick me out of my job, if you nationalize my bank, you won't be able to deal with it. It'll be too complicated. And the point that Simon Johnson made is that when you actually look at past financial crises like the one in Asia and others, in fact, when the government has gone in and has tried to clean up these banks or has hired people from the private sector to do so, unwinding them is actually mechanically not that difficult. Mm. Politically, it's more difficult than it is mechanically difficult.
Well, but what's happening now is that we're unraveling things. It's like peeling away layers of an onion because we're understanding, we're unpacking language. And, you know, we learned yesterday that performance-based pay doesn't even exist in most quarters, that at AIG, many employees had very low salaries, say $200,000, that's very low for Wall Street, but much larger guaranteed bonuses. So, for instance, when employees offered to give up those salaries, again, say around $200,000, and work for only a dollar in exchange for their bonuses, you know, if we read your article correctly today, they may have been trading $200,000 for $400,000, you know, the average bonus. So they weren't giving up anything.
That's right. And the way Wall Street pay works is that a lot of what the rest of us would consider base pay actually comes in the form of bonus.
Right.
And the historical justification for that was it allowed Wall Street to put this veneer of pay for performance on their pay. If you call it bonus, it seems like you're only getting it for doing a really good job. But not only do we now know, but we've in fact known for years that there is an enormous disconnect between the language to justify pay and the actual reasons why executives and Wall Street bankers are paid what they're paid. And I think this is an example of something that there actually were a lot of people sounding the alarm on this. I mean, when I think about what we in the media did and didn't do, I certainly think there are things we could have sounded the alarm more clearly and louder on in recent years. But this is something that business journalists at every publication, at the New York Times, at the Wall Street Journal, at Business Week, at Fortune, you name it, have been writing stories about this incredible disconnect between the amount people are paid and why they say they're getting it and why they're really getting it. And nothing's been done about it. And that's part of why I wonder, is something really going to be done about it now? And I'm of two minds. I think there's a chance something will be. I think there's a chance it'll actually happen naturally, even without any kind of government change. And I also think there's a chance that when the storm passes, we'll go back to these incredible payments, even when there is bad performance. And that's really the problem. If someone does a great job, if someone makes their company $100 million, and the shareholders of that company want to pay that person $10 million for the $100 million they made, I think you can defend that. You can't defend payments in any way when it's mediocre performance for gets you incredibly high pay.
Well, in just a second, we're going to be talking to an economist whose thinking is to tie pay more to stocks so that, you know, as the stocks rise and fall, so does pay, and also not to give out pay in such huge amounts, to give it out incrementally. But just give us one idea that jumps out at you. You've been talking to people as to how the pay structure should be changed.
Well, I'm going to give an idea that's actually a little broader than what executive compensation experts also often talk about. It's not that I don't think their ideas don't have potential. They may well have potential. But I would actually encourage people to think about the tax code here. The past efforts to tinker and find ways with executive pay have often not worked out. I actually think it's possible for them to work out in the future. But to me, the cleanest way to do this is actually to create a new tax bracket. Our top tax bracket is now right around $350,000, which means that our tax code doesn't treat the 400,000th dollar that someone makes any different than, say, the 10 millionth dollar that someone makes. And maybe that used to make sense when 400,000 was truly an astronomical amount of money. And to most of us, obviously, $400,000 sounds like a huge amount of money. But it's nothing compared to a lot of these salaries that we see. And it seems to me that we actually want a tax bracket above what is now the 35% tax bracket that starts at $400,000 of income. Maybe it starts at $1 million. Maybe it starts at $2 million. Maybe it is a tax bracket at 45%. And that basically reduces the incentive for these absolutely enormous paydays. The research we've seen shows that marginal tax rates of something like 45% aren't going to cripple the economy, despite the scare tactics we'll hear. They will raise some revenue, and we need some revenue going forward. And I also think they may be the most elegant way to attack part of this problem.
Okay, well, we're going to talk more about that. But David Leonhardt, one last question to you. Do you think that this huge uproar over bonuses, as Rick Newman from U.S. World and U.S. News and World Report was saying at the beginning of the program, is something that people really get? Do you think that this is going to destabilize the actual, you know, stimulus package to AIG, the bailout money to AIG? Because Rick is one of those people who says that's actually working. So what's your sense of that going forward?
I'm worried about that. The bailout, rescue, whichever word you want to use, of the credit markets is vitally important. A capitalist economy cannot function without credit markets. And so we can debate exactly how to bail out the credit markets. But we have to keep doing it. The lesson of Japan, the lesson of the Depression, the lesson of 2008 when we let Lehman Brothers fail and the markets did incredibly poorly in the months afterwards, the credit markets, is that you allow credit markets to collapse very much at your own peril.
David Leonhardt. David, we thank you as always. David's with the New York Times. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, let's check in with an economist who has some thoughts on restructuring executive pay. Also, later today, why aren't there more African-American Catholics? That's later, but we'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. So, how to pay executives on Wall Street if the current pay structure is the house of cards we're seeing at AIG? One economist is proposing a way that will force executives to have more skin in the game, as they say, so that if their companies don't do well, their wallets don't do well either. Alex Edmonds is assistant professor of finance at the Wharton School of Business, and he joins us from the school studios at the University of Pennsylvania. Alex, professor, welcome.
Thanks very much, Robin. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, first of all, tell us, what do you see as the problem? I mean, we've been talking about how performance pay isn't really performance pay, and I'm imagining that you agree.
That's indeed correct. So I see two main problems with the current system. So the current system give CEOs stock and options, presumably to align them with shareholders. However, in many cases, the CEOs are able to cash out early, i.e. sell the stock, and therefore they're no longer aligned with shareholders. And this can lead to problems. For example, the CEO can take short-term actions, such as writing subprime loans to pump up the stock price, then they can sell the stock. So when the loans eventually become delinquent and shareholders start suffering, the CEOs have already cashed out. So one prominent example is Countrywide. So the CEO there was able to make over $100 million by selling his stock before the start of the subprime crisis.
That's despicable, but yes. And so your idea would be what?
So I'll just first get to the second part of the
second
problem,
yes.
because mm-hmm. that gets us to the solution that we're proposing. So the second problem is that even if the executive is not allowed to cash out, the stock and options can lose their incentive effect over time. For example, if the company's in trouble and the stock price falls, the stock and options are worth very little, and therefore they don't have any incentive effect. So the CEO doesn't have skin in the game, even if he's retained the stock and options.
So
then back to your question mm-hmm. in terms of the solution. So the solution, which is written with not just myself, but also Xavier Gabex and Thomas Sadzik of NYU and Yuli Sanikov of Princeton, so they are all experts in compensation as well, involves two main features to address the two problems that I set out. So first, in terms of the problem of cashing out early, rather than giving the CEO salary and shares which she can immediately sell, these shares and the salary will be escrowed in what we're going to call an incentive account. So the important part of the escrowing is that the CEO can't get at it immediately. She can't immediately sell it. Instead, it vests slowly over time. And critically, even after the CEO retires, the account doesn't vest immediately. It still continues to vest slowly. And this addresses the problem that you had at Merrill Lynch at Countrywide, where the CEO can retire, cash everything out, and therefore can get off scot-free when the problems happen afterwards.
So this also is incentive for CEOs to stay at the job and not just leave.
That's right. So number one, it's incentive to stay at the job. And number two, even if you know that you're leaving, because every CEO needs to retire someday, that dissuades the CEO from just pumping up the stock price just before retirement, cashing out that high stock price, and therefore getting off scot-free when the stock price eventually plummets because the loans they've written have become delinquent.
It sounds as if your plan also strings pay in different ways out over a long period of time, and it avoids the huge payouts that we're seeing right now.
That's indeed true. So because you're tied to long-term performance rather than short-term stock price, you have an incentive to manage the company for long-run value rather than taking short-term actions.
How are these CEOs living in the meantime? Is this, you know, where their simple cash salary comes in? Does it act as a dividend of their stocks and options? How do they function?
Right, so clearly the CEO needs to consume. It can't be that you just hold up all of the CEO's pay because then they have nothing to live on. So the critical feature of the account is that they can withdraw a proportion of it each month. So this is the equivalent of the salary. So they can indeed withdraw to consume, but the bulk of it doesn't immediately vest, unlike many schemes that you see at the moment. So they can withdraw just more than enough for them to consume each month, but also there's sufficient cash and stock in the account that they have skin in the game.
Well, and how do you get this instituted? I mean, who gets behind something like this?
So something such as this, one option that you obviously have is for the government to regulate. But our solution is this is something that, if indeed it's something which will add value, this is something that shareholders and boards can implement themselves in the absence of government regulation. So it's something that we're at least just going to put on the radar screen for them to consider amongst all of the other proposals which have been made by other compensation experts. And if indeed something such as this will address the problems, then shareholders and boards can implement it themselves rather than the government having to regulate it.
Well,
but if I could just add, there was just a second feature of the scheme that I didn't mention. So I mentioned the escrowing, which addresses the problem of cashing out. I mentioned the second problem of losing the incentive effect over time. And so the second critical feature of the scheme was rebalancing. So if you give the CEO cash and stock to start with, and 60% of it is stock and 40% is cash, then if something bad happens to the company, so the stock falls and the the stock is now only 30% of the account. What the account will critically feature is that some of the cash in the account will be sold for stock, so that the CEO again now has 60% of the account in stock. So this makes sure that at all points in time, the CEO has enough skin in the game and avoids the problem that you have at present, which is when the stock price falls, the option's not worth anything, and therefore the CEO is not aligned with shareholders.
You mentioned
the two main features are the escrowing plus the rebalancing to address the two problems.
Plus, it would seem as if, in addition to escrowing, because it's an escrow, it can be clawed back by companies. They can take money back if they feel, you know, performance is not there. That's Alex Edmonds, Assistant Professor of Finance at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, with his idea for restructuring pay on Wall Street. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we'd like to know what you think. There are so many other ideas floating out there, caps on pay, but some people say that that doesn't work across the board. Or, as we heard from David Leonhardt, increasing the tax rate on the small group of very wealthy recipients, people making, you know, millions and millions of dollars. So let us know. Go to our website, hereandnow.org, and click on Contact Us. We'll continue to take a look at this. But we want to look ahead in the program, because we got a treat for you later on.
Ya no estás pensando claro, y ese amor te sale caro. Piensa los tuyos, solo los tuyos.
West Side Story is back on Broadway, and it's partially in Spanish. We'll speak to the director, the man behind the new West Side Story. That's after the news, here and now. In Detroit, a house costs less than a car. That's a recent headline in Oregon. And as we'll hear, people from around the world are coming to Detroit for homes. And one couple already there is seizing opportunity. Gina Reichert is an architect, her husband an artist. They started to see incredibly low-priced foreclosed homes near their house. They bought one home for $500, sold it to some artist friends for $550, and they sent other friends to a home for $100. Many of these houses have been stripped of wiring by scavengers. They've got broken windows, and now they're fixing them up. Well, we noticed Gina's story in the New York Times, and she joins us now. And Gina, the idea seems to be, on the one hand, to make homes sustainable, because you're trying to get them on off the electric grid, but you're also making them into art. One is painted with stripes, and you've said that this is art spectacle, but also you've created a community. Now, who are you bringing in?
We're trying to bring in people that have some kind of an art background, people who will move in but give back. You know, people have used the gentrification word, and that's exactly what we're trying not to do. We don't want to displace any of the local residents. We really want to create a dialogue between contemporary artists and the community that's already there.
Well, and how's that going? How's the community that's already there feeling about this?
So far, it's going really well. They know us from, you know, working on the garden, working on our house. Their houses need work done on them, so they come up and ask if we can help them work on their house. So some of our neighbors have hired us for, you know, small construction jobs. So far, the exchange has been really good. And we do have a list of, you know, informal proposals floating around of people who are interested in the neighborhood. So our goal is to try to involve the community in that process, too.
Well, and it's because some of the proposals are coming from around the world, and the international response is amazing. I mean, we understand city planners from Amsterdam have a project they call the Detroit Unreal Estate Agency. They brought a property.
They're working on buying a property, and they're bringing 10 international students from the Dutch Art Institute over in April to do projects in the neighborhood.
What are some of the other ideas that people have for you?
It's everything from, like, an old school photo studio where people from the neighborhood would come and have their portraits taken. And then it goes up to, like, bicycle repair shop, small cafe, print shop, skate park. The neighborhood sort of sits alongside a busy expressway, so the idea would be that some of the bigger skate park areas would be along the expressway in some vacant land, and then it could sort of come down the alley, because we have alleys between the garages, so it would create kind of this skate and bicycle path through the neighborhood.
It sounds as if this could start to get, you know, bigger. Do you worry that people are going to start seeing the houses on the street, that people might move in, go for some of these foreclosed homes that don't have your dream? I mean, that you can't really control it.
We do. It's something that we've been having a lot of conversations about since the Times article came out. So it is kind of the danger of getting all this attention. But the other reality is that we're still in Detroit, and Detroit isn't a fantasy dreamland. So you know, you still have to deal with things like crime and taxes that are higher than the services that you receive.
And why are you there with Detroit, really, perhaps at its nadir?
There's something about the city that's sort of comfortable, but not so comfortable that you become complacent. There are lots of issues as an architect and designer. I look around and I see all of the design problems and opportunities that exist here, and so that's kind of stimulating to me. And also, you can afford to live here pretty comfortably on a very small budget. So you don't spend all of your time and money trying to create an income just to pay the rent.
Well, and you're willing to live in an area where the homes are, you know, selling for $500. But I'm thinking, too, that Toby Barlow, in writing about you in the New York Times, writes, in a way, a strange new American dream can be found in Detroit amid the crumbling semi-majestic ruins of a half-century's industrial decline. Is there some appeal to that, too?
Yeah, so you have, it's sort of a different kind of American dream. It's not the dream of the two-car garage and the house in the suburbs. It's sort of a dream of, you know, I have time and space to develop my ideas, to spend with my family. So it's a different American dream.
Gina Reichert, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It was really nice speaking with you.
Okay, we'll be back in just half a minute. You're listening to Here and Now. Pope Benedict XVI has just begun a week-long visit, his first, to Africa, and he's making waves, saying yesterday in Cameroon that condoms won't overcome the fight against AIDS. In fact, they aggravate the problem. It's not a new position for the Catholic Church, but on a continent ravaged by HIV and AIDS, the Pope's words struck a chord. The Catholic Church in Africa is the fastest-growing church in the world, rivaled on the continent by Islam and evangelicals. Almost half the adult Catholic baptisms in the world occur in Africa, and it's home to the largest Catholic seminary. But the relationship between the Vatican and African Catholics has its problems, with conflicts over African cultural practices like polygamy and animal sacrifices. Let's learn more about this. Nick Creery is a scholar of African Catholicism and assistant professor of history at Ohio University. Nick, welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we should add, you're also Catholic and African-American, and you've spent several years in Africa studying Catholicism there. So first of all, what do you make of the Pope's statement, you know, the Church agrees with conservatives like George Bush that condoms give the false sense of security that can lead to more sexual behavior. But how do you think Catholics you know in Africa are going to react to that?
Well, I think you'll get a mixed response. I think, you know, the issue of condoms as a method of birth control, I think, is less of an issue for Catholics in Africa. I think the big issue becomes, as, you know, the Pope mentioned yesterday, it becomes an issue with HIV and AIDS.
But aren't there many Catholic, you know, even nuns and priests who disagree with the Pope because they help patients with AIDS?
Yes, there are. You know, several people, you know, good practicing, you know, believing Catholics that think that in the case of trying to prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS, that condoms should be allowed.
Well, let's get to today's news, because today The Pope said that although the Catholic Church in Africa is the fastest growing in the world, he noted the competition from superstitious forms of religion. What was he talking about there? Which forms of religion?
Sure. There he's talking about what we usually refer to as traditional African religions, the religions that developed over centuries, over millennia, across the continent. And I think he's concerned because usually the way it's always been discussed, you know, by missionaries there, is that Christianity is different from these religions, and Christianity has to purify these religions, these, you know, cultural expressions of the spiritual. And this is part of what he calls the process of enculturation. This is a relatively new term over the last 50 years to talk about how do we adapt Christianity to local cultures. And that is a concern on the part of African Catholics. When he talks about, you know, competition from these different sects, it's part of a larger discourse and discussion that goes back to the beginnings of the modern missionary endeavors to evangelize, where European missionaries saw African religions as basically forms of devil worship. And it's, you know, thankfully in the last 40, 50 years, there's been a change in that. This idea of enculturation, of saying that we can adapt and have a dialogue between culture and church. And so I think that to a certain extent, you could say that he is pulling back from some of the efforts to adapt and allowing space for those conversations to happen. I mean, one of the reasons he's in the Cameroons, you know, is to drop off the working document for the upcoming synod that's going to be happening, where all the bishops from Africa are being called to Rome in October. And this is problematic because this is the second time now that African bishops aren't allowed to have a meeting, you know, a synod meeting on the African continent.
Well, that's a very interesting take, Nick, because John Allen, he's been on our program often. He writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's with the Pope in Africa. He had a different view of this. The title of his article is 2009 is Shaping Up as the Year of Africa and Catholicism. And he points to the very synod you mentioned, which is scheduled for next October, as being sort of a great for Africa that the Pope, who calls these meetings at his will, has decided that the topic is going to be Africa and that the bishops are being brought from Africa to the Vatican to meet with bishops from around the world. But you're seeing it as sort of a paternalistic thing. You're seeing it as, you know, why can't they meet in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, because the North American bishops met in the United States, the Latin American bishops met in Latin America, the Asian bishops met in Asia, and yet the African bishops were summoned to Rome. I mean, I think John is right in many respects in that, you know, given the growth of the church on the African continent, given the vibrancy and the youth of the church, roughly almost half of the people on the African continent are under the age of 15. So there's a really, you know, vibrant church that's happening across the continent. But I worry about, as you called it, you know, the paternalism that I see in summoning the bishops to Rome. I mean, I think, yes, it's wonderful that they're having this meeting, that they're going to have these discussions. God knows, they're tremendously important. But why can't it happen on the continent is my question.
Well, perhaps we have clues in some of the other things the Pope said today. He mentioned the fear of competition from superstitious, mysterious forms of faith in Africa. Mm-hmm. He also said that African Catholics should beware of local African rites. He said, exuberant local African rites should not obstruct the liturgy of the clergy. Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of those rites that maybe African Catholics are working into their services?
Yes. For example, I mean, in many African cultures, you know, there are rites that honor ancestor spirits. The doctrine that once you die, the spirit of a person has the ability to intercede on behalf of people still alive on Earth. And yet African forms of invoking those spirits are very different from what you find in the Catholic Mass, things where you would have drumming and dancing. I mean, this is a very common form of interaction between the human and the spiritual world in African cultures.
And, you know, so here we have the Pope traveling to Africa and sort of, you know, warning that he's worried about some of these local customs. And I'm just wondering, you seem to be fearful as well that he's turning back the clock a little bit. But here you are, an American, African-American Catholic, a very small community, only about 2.5 million blacks, making up about 3% of all Catholics in America, which would seem to make sense, you know, because when Africans first came to America, for most it was on slave ships, and they went to the deeply Protestant South initially. But why else do you think more African Americans aren't Catholic?
Well, that's a function of the church's history in the United States, and I would say that it's largely a history of failure. The church after the Civil War, you know, one of the Archbishop of Baltimore said, you know, we have a golden opportunity, which if we don't, you know, take advantage of this now, we'll be gone forever. And they didn't take advantage of that opportunity. It was very limited response in an effort to try to evangelize the then 4 million freed slaves. Mm-hmm. It's basically been a history of benign neglect, of disobedience on the part of the American bishops for much of the 20th century in terms of trying to evangelize African Americans. It's only really in the last 40, 50 years that there's been a significant effort on the part of the institution of the bishops as a whole to try to reverse that.
Well, given that history, what's the appeal for you?
Because I believe that this is, you know, the church that was established by Jesus Christ, and it is larger than any human failings or any failings on the part of the institutional church. Going back to the days of slavery, African Americans have been a part of this church, and, you know, we stay because it is our church. Just because the leadership in many cases may not, you know, see, you know, the light of truth, that doesn't mean that we aren't still here and that we aren't believing and we don't accept the gospel message as, you know, preached, you know, for thousands of years.
Nick Creery is assistant professor of history and a scholar of African Catholicism at Ohio University, commenting on both his own faith and the Pope's visit to Africa, this current Pope's first visit to that continent. Nick, Professor Creery, thanks so much for your insight.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we will be back in a minute with some of the greatest music ever written in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. This is a big week for 91-year-old playwright and director Arthur Lawrence. His memoir, mainly on directing, Gypsy, West Side Story, and other musicals, was just published. And tomorrow night, West Side Story, the landmark 1957 musical of love and warring gangs in New York, for which he wrote the original book, comes back to Broadway under his direction. The new production showcases Leonard Bernstein's score and Jerome Robbins' choreography, but it's also dramatically different.
Hoy me siento tan hermosa, tan graciosa que puedo volar.
Director Arthur Lawrence joins us from his home in New York City. And Arthur, first of all, why bring it back? And why bring it back partly in Spanish?
The whole thing began because of my late partner, Tom Hatcher. He saw a Spanish language production of West Side Story in Bogota, Colombia. And when the hometown language was Spanish, he was struck by the fact that the Sharks became the heroes and the Jets were the villains.
Yeah, let's remind ourselves, it's a modern Romeo and Juliet, but instead we have Tony and Maria. Tony struggling to disengage from his gang, the Jets, and the Jets are made up of Italian, Polish, Irish, New York immigrants. The Sharks are Puerto Rican. Maria's brother Bernardo leads the Sharks. Her friend Anita is Bernardo's girlfriend. So you have the Sharks and the Jets. And you and others saw this problem with this construct, that somehow the Sharks, the Puerto Ricans, seem more like the bad guys than the Jets.
Well, that's really because they don't have as much stage time.
They don't have any songs.
They really don't. The Jets are on stage much more and have much more to do. But giving them Spanish gives them weight and makes them much stronger than they were in the original.
And so how do you sprinkle the Spanish throughout West Side Story? Because when Anita sings, "I want to be in America," she's trying to be American, so she will speak in English.
Exactly. It wasn't as simple as I thought it was going to be. And what happens with Anita is when Bernardo, her lover, is killed, she reverts to Spanish.
Oh.
She no longer wants to be American.
Oh.
Using Spanish was a fresh approach, and that made for changes. And changes beget other changes.
What were some of the other changes?
I can give you an example. The opening Jet song in 1957 was done as a kind of lightweight musical number.
When you're a Jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When
you're Here a it jet, is very angry and vicious, because in 1957, those gangs were treated as kind of adorable little thugs, which they weren't then and they're not now. Consequently, the song has to be done differently. Even the dancing has to be done differently. They're Jerry Robbins steps, but where before you had, you know, kind of soft lyrical arms, now they're hard with clenched fists.
We should mention that in putting together this new West Side Story, you brought in Lin-Manuel Miranda, who brought In the Heights from off-Broadway to Broadway. This was his own story of growing up in the New York area, a very young voice, and he told you how much West Side Story had influenced him, and yet, like many others in your current production who were Hispanic, they felt that sort of hole in their heart about this play, didn't they?
Yes, they did. But, you know, now what is gratifying to me is members of the Spanish or Hispanic community come up to me and thank me for this production because they feel they are, for the first time, represented on Broadway.
Well, as you know, some critics worry that people who don't know the musical won't understand the parts in Spanish, and people who love the musical will miss the English, so we'll see. But let's listen to a moment in Spanish. This is when Anita discovers that Maria has just been with Tony, who's just killed Bernardo, Anita's boyfriend and Maria's brother. Now, Stephen Sondheim, who wrote the lyrics, told your translator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, just keep the rhyme scheme. And we know in this song the original lyrics were, a boy like that who killed your brother, forget that boy and find another. Let's listen to the new lyrics.
Si mata no tiene amor, si mata no hay corazón.
Anita, in Lin's translation, doesn't sing a boy like that, and my approach to it was quite different. She's not angry, as was in the play and in the movie, which I really didn't like. And unfortunately, that's all that most people know West Side Story by, is the movie. They never saw the show. And I thought the Puerto Ricans were treated like terrible stereotypes in the movie.
What else did you have to do? As you said, most people saw the movie, and as much as you might love it, the members of the gangs look like they might be chorus boys or...
In the movie.
Yeah, in the movie. How do you, I mean, what else, as a director, what else do you bring to the stage to bring the sort of danger and reality that
well,
is on the stage?
Well, the movie and the original play were about how to tell the story. This production is about what the story is about, which is about can love survive in a world of bigotry and violence.
There's a place for us, a time and place for us.
That means you need a lot of acting. And the gang members become actors in this. Every one of them is a character. They weren't originally.
We're speaking to West Side Story book author and director of the new Broadway production, Arthur Lawrence. He's also the author of Mainly on Directing Gypsy, West Side Story and Other Musicals.
May I say one thing?
Please.
The real title of the book is Mainly on Directing because it is also about, a lot of it, about my life.
Let's just touch on that for a second. You say as a gay man and a Jewish man, stories about outsiders and conflict come to you quite easily.
Oh, yes. I'm an outsider. In a funny way, I think most people are outsiders. And they connect with something that relates to them. And the last paragraph in the book is really what I and the book are about.
And I'm right there. Let's see. It's about your partner, Tom, and theater, and your life has been the two.
Right.
How lovely that through implementing his idea on the stage, you have kept him alive.
Well, that's what I try to do.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.